Welcome to the T2 Hubcast with me, Spencer Locker.
And me, Martin Johnson.
Martin Johnson. Long time no speak.
It's been some time since I actually said that.
Yes.
And it's because our time for podcasting these days is like precious.
Isn't it?
But we need to do it more. And yeah, I was excited to come in today and do this, not only because of the topic and because of the idea, but because it has been some time.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially with you, Spence. The last time me and you was actually in the podcast room.
I think we were actually, the last time we were together was, well, a long time ago. We was out there rather than in here.
Could be 2023, you know.
Most definitely. Yeah. Most definitely. Anyway, excitement building. The eagerly anticipated follow-up to I Am Human, 30 Mistakes to Success is on its way. It's done. It's just been going through that process. But I Am Human, Pain and Pleasure. This follow-up, this it's really exciting. Was it a difficult second album?
Yeah, it is. I think it is, but it was self-inflicted difficult second album. For those who read I Am Human, 30 Mistakes to Success, which I wrote in 2017 now. I know. Mm. 7 years ago, is that?
Yeah.
You know, it's a long time. The book surpassed my expectations in terms of the number of sales, the number of people who read it, the comments I got, the genuine reviews were great. So I always initially commissioned a three-book publishing deal,
right,
with the Big Ideas Library. And I thought to myself after book one, I'm going to give myself 10 years before I do the next one, because the last one took me about a year to write. And I find writing a hard process. I don't mind admitting that. As good as we are at speaking for a living, writing is a whole different kettle of fish. So I struggled with book one. And so anyway, I the reason for book two was I'd been having this idea for I Am Human 2, in a sense, which is now, as you say, is named Pain and Pleasure. And it was this notion 7 years later of going, building on book one, how do we go into a bit more depth into the human psyche and track back right to the beginning of mankind and plot our evolution to the world we live in today and sum up that there are these two things called pain and pleasure which govern every single thing we do and always have. And if you simplify and strip it down, what I want to achieve with this book is to give people in the modern day an idea of how their brain is working, governed by the ability to either endure pain and discomfort or seek pleasure and reward, and get really actionable and practical with tips on if your skills have tipped out of balance, i.e. you can't endure pain and suffering as much anymore, or you find it difficult to, or you're struggling to seek pleasure and reward and purpose, then one of your skills is out of balance. Something has tipped out of kilter. So the whole book is aimed to try and educate people on what makes the scales balance and what can you do to, you know, to get your scales back in kilter.
I think this is something that I really enjoyed with the first book. I found it really accessible. I found it, he's not just telling people things, he's putting it into a context. And when it goes into a context, people can find it actionable. And I think that it's following on into book two, I'm Human, Pain and Pleasure. He's following on in that. I mean, if I can...
And I was going to say, Spence, you know this because you are one of the very few people who have had a sneak peek read before it's gone to the publisher.
Well, yeah. And this is the thing, is I'd love to talk to you about it, but I don't want to do a Peter Kay, who knew it, Bruce Willis, a ghost. So I don't want to talk about the entire book. Okay. I mean, we know it's going to be available very shortly, and it's going to be available directly from us and Amazon and all the good places. However, when I was doing that sneak peek preview bit, I really started getting into chapter two. Chapter two, for me, was that bit where we sort of went, right, very eye-opening, very sort of, I get it. And I understand, I can put it into my own context. So the concept of that chapter two was that hardwired to seek pleasure and avoid pain. So I think you say in the book, if I can refer to my notes, we avoid pain and seek pleasure in almost all situations apart from two. So the first is that which gives us great reward in exchange for some pain. This can be seen as development and growth. Second, true survival, fight or flight.
Yeah.
Now, we've talked about that second one, but that really interesting about that development and growth. So can you just sort of give us a little bit more depth then to that? So why is it that some people really lean into development and growth and really enjoy it and some people don't? And there's obviously touch points in between.
So if you're talking about chapter two in the book, the chapter is actually titled The Pain and Pleasure Complex.
Right.
And in chapter one, we've set the scene on the history of humankind. And we've sort of painted the picture that we're unquestionably human. And we explored those three core functions of human existence in chapter one, which are, when you strip us right back, and we always say this here at T2, We have three core functions of our existence, which is survival. Self-preservation is still our innate number one function. Continuation of the species, find a mate and reproduce. And three, purpose. Whilst we're here, we need to have a role, a purpose, a sense of contribution and belonging.
Yeah.
So all species on Earth have those three core functions, and certainly the first two, survival and continuation. So I sort of set the scene in chapter one around that's why our system, our brain and body system is designed to be motivated either away from pain and danger, survival, or towards pleasure and reward, sex and reproduction. Because they underpin the two main functions that our species has to undertake, which is stay alive and continuation. So pain and pleasure is hardwired into us for those reasons. So when I go into chapter two, as you've read and it clearly struck a chord with you, I say, well, what is pain and pleasure? And how does it work in terms of motivating our behaviours, actions and reactions? And so it's quite an in-depth chapter around that. But yeah, I make that statement of, if you think survival is our number one innate function, we are hardwired to avoid pain and discomfort at all costs, primarily to keep us alive and protect us or to protect our offspring. However, there are two situations where this doesn't apply. So we can avoid pain and discomfort if something presents a true and immediate danger to our lives. We have got to face it. We have got to thrust ourselves into it and either fight it or get the hell out of there, right? We've got to do something with it, which means we've got to endure it. So we know that that's quite a transactional, quite instinctive thing. The second one, though, is where we are willing to endure some pain and discomfort in exchange for a potential reward and fulfillment at the end of it. So it's almost like we're acknowledging that there's potential risk, there's uncertainty, there's a level of challenge, right? And this is going to be difficult. And guess what? There could be consequences. But what we're driven by is that by doing this or putting ourselves in this position, there could be an exchange of fulfillment, reward, or pleasure at the end of it. Not only that, Spence, but it could be fulfillment, reward, and pleasure greater than I can ever experience in my normal neutral state.
Right, okay.
And that's where the three states come from, which I'm sure you're going to touch upon, but challenge state, threat state, neutral state.
Right, yeah.
Comes from, depending on which decisions we've made, what state of mind, psychological state we're in at any one time.
Right, okay. And now you mentioned that, I'll have to go there because, he's quite interesting with this book because at T2, we talk quite a lot about challenge versus threat state, how are we going to focus on what we want to do and how we're going to do it rather than what we don't want to do and what we want to avoid. And it serves our customers, our delegates very, very well. And I've got to say, some of the staff as well. We sometimes when we're in that sort of situation of overwhelm or something like that, to be able to sort of take that check step and go, whoa, right, so what am I, what this thing that I'm feeling overwhelmed by, how can I deal with that? What am I going to do about it? What's in my sphere of control? But when we start talking, when we start reading two, as you said there, you alluded to the fact that we've got challenge state, threat state, and a neutral state. So I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about your what you talk about with the neutral state.
Yeah, and what's worth mentioning at this point, and I go on in the book in later chapters to really explore this, and this is why I'm proud of this piece of work, because I think it gives the complete picture and all the nuances of personality styles and attributes and how different people respond to different things. So given that we know our core functions as a species is survival, reproduction, and purpose, we know that that applies to every single person walking the planet. Neutral challenge and threat state applies to every single person walking the planet. However, the unique personality types and weird and wonderful differences of humans and attributes and characteristics means that we all perceive situations differently. So what could be a challenge state situation for me could be a threat state situation for you.
Sure. Yeah.
Could well be a neutral state situation for an adrenaline junkie, right?
Yeah.
So we're all weird, and we can come to that later in this pod.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to answer your question, we talk a lot about threat and challenge. Just for the listeners, threat state being a situation where your brain perceives that situation as presenting a true or immediate danger to you. And what once was a true or immediate danger to your life, i.e. poisonous berries, a snake, saber-toothed tiger, a war with another tribe, whatever it was, in modern day life, we can still perceive situations as a threat state, even though they don't present an immediate and clear danger to our lives. So threat state is, though, when your system, your brain, is trying to do two things. Fight it and take this on, or get the hell out of here because we are feeling so compromised.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas a challenge state, similar response in the brain and the system, but with a slight difference. So we still feel that nervousness around something isn't quite right, or this carries consequence, this could harm me, it carries risk, exposure, whatever it might be. However, we are looking at the situation that if we take it on and succeed, this could be amazing. Mm. This could give me the motivation. This actually could turn into purpose and fulfillment. Mm. So the difference is I'm going to rise to the challenge and take this on and acknowledge the risks rather than just becoming fearful by them and wanting to get out of there or solve it as quick as I can. Mm. So let's talk as an example. Public speaking.
Yeah.
For one person, this could induce a challenge state. Oh, I'm quite scared and daunted. Mm. What if I go wrong? Mm. What if I get judged? What if it doesn't land very well? But then your brain switches to, this could be an opportunity to impress.
Mm.
This could be an opportunity to inspire and engage people.
Yeah.
This could push myself and increase my skills and confidence.
Right.
I'm up for it. Challenge state.
Yeah.
Whereas another person could go, oh my God, this is the worst thing I've ever experienced. I would rather die than speak in public. You're going to look daft. You're going to look silly. You don't know what you're talking about. The sound of your voice sounds awful. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Because they've gone into a threat state. They're focused solely on the consequence and what's going to go wrong. So that's an example of a challenge or a situation where one person could rise to the challenge in a challenge state and one could, succumb to the threat and either avoid it or just get it over and done with as quick as you can and get out of there.
Yeah.
The neutral state, however, is this state of mind where we are neither challenged and heading towards any form of triumph, elation, or victory.
Yeah.
But we're neither feeling any sort of pressure, stress, duress, or uncertainty.
Okay.
We are in our comfort zone.
Yeah.
We are even keel. That might be sat at home having a glass of wine, sat in the office having a coffee with your colleague talking about the football the night before.
Yeah.
It might be walking your dog at 5 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
I know that's probably yours. That's yours, Spence.
Yeah.
But your neutral state is when you're neither tested, challenged, or pushed, nor are you in any danger, uncertainty, or any risk. You are even. And in this book, I've written a whole chapter on this because we've always made a big play, Spence, about challenge and threat.
Yeah.
And rightly so. How do people deal with threat state? And how do you rise to the challenge and perform optimally under pressure? We've always dealt with that.
Well, yeah, I suppose we've dealt with it because that's the thing that can either challenge or put somebody in anxiety. If people are in the neutral zone, well, that's the comfort zone, so we'll, I'm all right there. But because we don't talk about it, it goes unnoticed, really.
Whereas what I found through recent studies and in a lot of our data and a lot of things is the neutral state plays as an important role as the other two, if not more important.
Right.
So in this book, I brought it into the mix and I've talked at length about we must find time for our neutral zone. Some of us, like me, don't. I'm not very good doing nothing. I feel like I need to be on to the next challenge or I need to be busy or doing something. Some people spend too much time in their neutral zone, which is equally as damaging. So it's like Goldilocks' porridge with these three states.
Yeah.
We were never designed as a species, Spence, to spend too much time in one state.
Right.
Okay. We was designed to be able to flip between the states, depending on the situation in front of us, and then be able to return to a different state in the aftermath. So an example of this would be a hunter-gatherer tribe years ago. They wake up in the morning, right? They wake up in the morning and they instantly turn to challenge state. They've got to go out. They've got to find food. They've got to hunt. They've got to forage. It's dangerous. They've got to go and do that. So the challenge state kicks in. Could be uncertain out there, but we need this to survive. Let's go. Rise to the challenge. So they'll go out. They find the food, whatever it might be. They encounter a predator. An hour into the search, threat state. So they've switched into this heightened level of awareness that actually my life is at risk now. So I need to make some quick decisions. Do I fight the threat? Do I not? The threat subsides. They deal with it in any way. Back into challenge state. Right, let's go find the food. They eventually find some food. They come back to the camp in the evening. Everybody relaxes in their neutral state as they enjoy their catch of the day, which is much needed to bring the system back down from all that adrenaline and all of that chemical-induced sort of, you know, emotion that they've experienced throughout the day. No one's ever designed to stay in one. If you sit in your neutral state all day, every day, you know, reflection turns into self-loathing. You know, thinking about the past turns into procrastination. Future planning turns into hypothetical worrying because you've got too much time for introspection. You've got too much time at neutral state. If you spend all your time in challenge, just constantly taking on the next big thing, you will burn out. It's unsustainable. And if you spend all your time in threat, you will fast head towards anxiety or shutdown.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if you're in that sort of neutral state, where you're not necessarily focused on a challenge, then maybe it's not, and again, it's not ultimate challenge. It could be a little challenge or it could be a little bit of threat or something like that. But one of the things that we talk about, or one of the things that you talk about, is neurotransmitters and neuromodulators. So again, this isn't necessarily just sat there staring at the campfire with your lump of meat or your berries or whatever. But okay, so what do we mean? I mean, straight away we start talking about dopamine. And I'm sure that many of our listeners and our subscribers, we love you subscribers, by the way, they know about dopamine. But what I liked about what we put down here was putting it into a context. So dopamine, so it's a neuromodulator, it's a brain chemical, it's bouncing around in it. Yeah, but what does that look like to your average man on the street? What does that look like? And I think that chapter two does a really good job of actually putting some meat on the bones so that people can look at that and go, oh, that makes sense. Actually, that makes sense because in my world, dopamine is stimulated by this.
Well, dopamine features in the book quite a lot. I mentioned many neuromodulators, neurotransmitters, like you say, which are, let's make them simple, chemicals in the brain that are released to make you move, think, and feel in a certain way. we talk about cortisol and adrenaline spiking in a threat state to make you, your hand-eye coordination reduces, your blood flows to the muscles, your vision tunnels, your heart rate increases, all in a bid to prepare you to fight the fight.
Yeah.
So I talk about cortisol and adrenaline. Dopamine, however, has been long debated and known as our motivation molecule. It's our thing that gives us the reward when we achieve something. Well, what modern-day neuroscience and pharmacology show is that dopamine is actually, it's a step earlier. It's not a result of achieving something. It's actually the imagination and thought of achieving something.
Anticipation of reward.
Anticipation of reward. Yeah. So it's like, I might go, right, I want to challenge myself. I need to get in shape. I need to do something. So I need a goal. I'll climb Everest. So you might be sat there thinking about the glory of climbing Everest, the elation you would feel on the summit, the fulfillment. You know, you're thinking, and all of a sudden dopamine is releasing in your brain. It's almost like, you know, you're getting pleasure and reward at the sheer thought of getting pleasure and reward. So dopamine plays a really good role, a big role in our motivation towards actually going to do something. So if you ever find yourself in a challenge state on an endeavor, it's probably 3 months earlier when you thought about doing this that the first burst of dopamine came in your brain to almost sort of bring it alive in your mind and sort of generate this moment where the idea was hot and the motion was high and we're going for it. So dopamine is the anticipation of achieving something that's going to give you that purpose and fulfillment. And so therefore it's a very powerful thing. But what we also know is dopamine releases in sort of minor situations and major bursts. So it's like you could have a small dopamine release by getting a like or a comment on social media. You can get a dopamine release by someone saying thank you or well done for a job. It's not all about climbing Everest and running 3-hour marathons. It can be something subtle. And if you imagine back then, dopamine played a role a handful of times a day. Yeah. You go out there in the morning, you're motivated by the dopamine to go and find the food because you know that if you go and find the food and you envisage you and your tribe sat around a campfire that evening eating the meal, that's getting you up. That's getting you at them. Your dopamine releases, therefore, when you catch the catch, when you return, it releases into the evening when everybody thanks you for the meal. So you're having these bursts in controlled doses. You fast forward to today, and we look now at the research and the science behind what triggers dopamine release, and it is unbelievable the amounts of dopamine release and encounters that we are facing on a daily basis.
So like what, for instance?
So there's two ways to really release dopamine if you think about it as a human. There is chemically induced alcohol, tobacco, drugs, chocolate, caffeine, you know, sugars. There are things that you put in your body, substances, that will release dopamine.
Yeah.
Then there's experiences that release dopamine, which are not as a result of a direct substance entering the body. It's as a result of achieving something or euphoria or an experience or whatever it might be. So you imagine these days, A, how much access to those, you know, high dopamine releasing substances that we have to put into our bodies. It's far more than our ancient ancestors ever had, number one. And number two, you think about the experiences that we're exposed to and the things that... So, for example, digital drugs. Dr. Anna Lemke, in the book Dopamine Nation, talks about this new wave of digital drugs. And she's talking about online. She's talking about online gaming, online gambling, pornography, social media, this 24/7 access to stuff that triggers a dopamine release in the brain. Whether that's you put a photo up on Facebook and you get likes and comments and adulation and you release dopamine. Whether that's you go on online roulette and you win $50 on your first spin, dopamine. Whether that's you access online pornography, dopamine. you know, gaming, dopamine, whatever it might be, 24 hours to live streaming on Netflix, eating chocolate, eating fatty foods, eating takeaways, you know, whatever it might be, we're depleting the dopamine system far quicker and far more regular than we ever did before.
Right, okay. So if that is the case, because, I mean, just to sort of rewind a little bit. So one of the things that you were talking about was back in the day, you'd get sort of a measured a dopamine release because of the hunting, gathering or whatever. And obviously as we've evolved, this has evolved as well. So again, we talk a lot about teamwork and we talk a lot about leadership. And one of the things we talk about is how we communicate with our people. How do we release dopamine? Because that actually makes us feel good. And when we start talking about recognizing what people do, then actually it gets them thinking, well, I'll do more of that then. So we get people, we can cast that cultural shadow and we can get people to behave in certain ways by recognizing certain behaviors and they get that dopamine hit. And yeah, okay, so it's positive reinforcement. But now we're getting to that point where, as you said there, there's lots of different stimulus. There's lots of different things out there that can release dopamine or stimulate dopamine release in our brains. But it's not all the same for everybody, is it?
No, but if you think about it like this, and you're right, so if you just have a... If we rewind and think... So when I was doing the research for this book, there's an awful lot of research you've got to do to substantiate the current up-to-date evidence around things like our understanding of dopamine.
Yeah.
One of the leading people doing this is Andrew Huberman of the Huberman Lab.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he's given the simplest explanation of the actual dopamine system that makes sense. So, and I've then evolved that and sort of used my own analogy to try and explain it to people. So if you think about dopamine, you have in the brain, you have dopamine receptors. Think of those like the stalk of a plant and they sit there and stay there. And then the brain produces dopamine, the brain and body produces dopamine, and dopamine then replenishes and sits into the receptors as molecules.
Yeah.
And therefore, when all your receptors are full with your dopamine molecules, you've got a full reservoir of dopamine ready to explode or burst or feed you at any moment that you experience some type of pleasure, reward, anticipation, motivation, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So what's them flowers called, Spence? Because something's just come to my mind and I'm going to ask you. And this is going to be a test of your flower knowledge. It might not even be a flower. It could be a weed. What's those things you get in the summer where you blow them and the white fur fluff goes into the...
Oh, the...
They're not dandelions, are they? All right.
No, it's clock. We call them clock.
Yeah. So you'll have to research this and get the answer by the end of the pod. But anyway, I'm using this as a visual analogy. So your dopamine receptors are the stalk, they sit in your brain.
Yeah.
Your dopamine molecules sit on the receptors. And then when you experience something that gives you that drive, motivation, anticipation, reward, or fulfillment, the receptors release the dopamine molecule into the system in the brain and you feel motivated, elated, amazing, fulfilled.
Yeah.
We've got the answer from Tom. They're dandelions.
They are dandelions.
I was right. How did we not know that? So dandelions start off with the yellow the yellow top, and then they end up going into the white, which when the wind blows or you blow it just evaporates into the air and just leaves a stalk.
Right.
So I'm using this as an analogy because imagine every single time you encounter a dopamine releasing encounter, somebody blows on that receptor and the molecule just starts to feed into the system. So the reason that's important to understand is because once the receptor gives way to the dopamine molecule, your body and brain has to replenish levels of dopamine afterwards.
Right.
And that doesn't happen instantly.
Right. Okay.
So, and they don't know the exact science of timing because, like you just mentioned, everybody's different. Mm. And some people have higher natural baseline levels of dopamine than others to start with.
Yeah.
And they believe that this is probably down to biology, you know, genes, or a mixture of the way the brain's responded to the environment over the years. But everyone has different levels, baseline levels, and everybody probably replenishes at different types of speeds. Mm. However, we all have a system that works in the same way.
Yeah.
Dopamine is released and you need to replenish it.
Mm.
So for many years, hundreds of thousands of years, we've not been exposed to the high octane environment with the number of dopamine releasing activities that we are today.
Right.
So we were able to release it, feel pleasure, reward and fulfillment from an endeavor or a task we took on or an experience we experienced. And then we were able to replenish at an adequate speed in order for the next time it happened, we had our dopamine levels back to baseline to be able to go again.
Yeah.
So with the repetition and the repeated overexposure to things like digital drugs, we are depleting our dopamine systems more regularly, more frequently.
Yeah.
And if we don't take time to break that cycle of exposure, we are not able to then experience the same level of pleasure and reward when we repeat the activity, primarily because we haven't replenished the same levels of dopamine and we're already operating at a deficit.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So we do something and it gives us a buzz.
Yeah.
Then we do it again and it doesn't give us that much of a buzz, maybe.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned online gambling, not something that I do, but I know a few people do. So that thing that you do and it gives you a reward of 50 quid and then you do it again and you might get another 50 quid. But the thing is, if you continue to win 50 quid, well, actually, I want more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now, because the levels of dopamine have been depleted and not been replenished, so now actually 50 quid... let's go for 100 quid.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. An example of overexposure to dopamine releasing activities and then the numbing effects of it would be the more you do something, the more you habituate. So there's a great term for this called habituation.
Yeah.
When you habituate on something,
yeah,
it means you form a habit of doing it and you create an overexposure to it.
Yeah.
And therefore... every single time you do that, the effects of it, you become numb to them.
Right.
So this is where addiction can come from.
I was just about to say that, yeah.
So people like Dr. Anna Lemke talk about addiction and they've got quite a large study on addiction, but dopamine is largely responsible for addictive behaviours and addiction. And basically there are certain things, substances and experiences that have a high addictive liability.
Mm.
So if something's got a high addictive liability, it means that it has the ability to constantly release dopamine and release it at higher quantities and bigger bursts than usual.
Mm.
So chocolate is high addictive liability.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So chocolate, the reason, if you're listening to this and you're a chocoholic, right?
Yeah.
And you just think, I'm not having any chocolate this week. And then you get to Friday night and you think, I'll have one cube.
Yeah.
I'm going to have one cube of chocolate.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, you've hit the giant bar of galaxy.
Your Augustus Gloop with it all around your mouth.
That is not your fault, right? I'm going to back you up. That is because chocolate has high addictive liability because it has a wonderful way of releasing dopamine and it feels and tastes amazing and it makes you want to repeat the activity. So that's an example. Class A drugs.
Right.
Class A drugs have a high addictive liability. Alcohol, high addictive liability.
Right.
Gambling, high addictive liability. So what happens is when you no longer, so to use your example of winning £50 on roulette, when you've done that a few times and then you've lost a load and then you're trying to win, no longer does £50 cut it.
Mm.
So you have to double or triple down to get the same buzz.
Mm.
So if I double or triple down and I win $150, I get this elative burst of dopamine and a good feeling again.
Mm.
But where does it stop, Spence? And this is where gambling addiction comes from. Mm. This is where when you become numb to winning large amounts of money because it's no longer doing it for you, that never-ending search of more and bigger and better takes over.
Yeah.
When three beers on a Friday night is no longer enough, you need to nudge it to five. Mm. Then a bottle of wine, two bottles of wine, five gins, wherever you go next.
Right, yeah.
When cocaine no longer does it for you, because you've already moved on from marijuana.
Yeah.
Where do you go after cocaine, right? So Dr. Lemke talks about this a lot, and in her research is fascinating around addictive behaviours, but it's largely down to overexposure to things with a high addictive liability. The effects to those things become numb, so you've got to push the envelope or double or triple down on it in order to get the same buzz.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So what we're taking out of that is that Willy Wonka is a drug dealer.
Yeah. Okay, no, this is why I love podcasts with you, because we're in a very serious conversation talking about the new book, and that will be the thing people will remember.
We're back. Yes, okay. No, seriously. So what you've said, absolutely fascinating. I totally buy into it. I totally get it. I totally understand it. So what you're sort of saying is, when we get that hit from the dopamine, when we get that sort of anticipation of reward, whether it's the electronic drugs, the electrical drugs, the online drugs, whatever you call them, sorry, but Anna Lemke, what Anna Lemke calls them. So that gives us that up, yeah? However, we try and repeat that, we try and replicate that, but we haven't replaced that dopamine, so we go down.
Yeah.
So what does that look like?
Well, yeah, there is absolutely evidence and science around this thing that they call the post-dopamine slump.
Right.
And, you know, naturally, if you're pushing into things which are giving you these highs, therefore depleting the system, you're going to inevitably have some crashes and some lows. You're going to essentially have levels below baseline. Mm. So for example, if you've ever done something like you've pushed yourself to do a big talk on a stage, let's talk about what we do, Spence. Mm. If you've got as experienced as you are, if you've got a big important gig that's coming up,
yeah,
and you know you're going to stand on a stage, microphoned up in front of hundreds, if not thousands of people,
yeah,
right? You want to get it right. You've been building to this moment. You've been releasing dopamine all week at the thought of standing there with a round of applause, glory, nailing it, right? Yeah. The nerves kick in as you get towards the event. So your adrenaline and cortisol now start kicking in.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's another big hit on the system. You deliver your presentation 45 minutes in front of this big audience. You absolutely nail it. Stand innovation, round of applause. You feel in that moment, correct me if I'm wrong, Spence, on top of the world.
Certainly, absolutely.
There's nothing you can possibly do online or in your neutral state or that any other thing in the world will do that will give you that same experience. Mm. And then you come off, you do some one-to-one discussions with some of the audience members who have queued up to stay back and give you some kind comments.
Yeah.
And you say bye to the organisers.
Yeah.
And then you get in your car.
Yeah.
And you're on top of the world.
Yeah.
And you're on the way home.
Yeah.
And listening to your music.
Yeah.
Victory. What happens after that? I can tell you what happens because I do the same job as you.
Yeah.
By the time you get halfway home in the car, you are knackered.
Yes. Yeah.
You are reaching, your energy levels are plummeting. And not only that, but when you get home, you don't want to speak to anybody.
Mm.
You don't want to speak to anyone.
Mm.
Your wife and kids have missed you all day, right? You just want to get in the shower.
Yeah.
Right. And go to bed. Because this post-dopamine slump, this post-elation slump is inevitable. Because your system's been on high. You've used all your energy sources in this bid to do this.
Yeah.
And so if that's periodic and you're doing one gig every 2 weeks or one gig a month, that's sustainable. Because you get to go home for the weekend or the evening, rest in your neutral state, recharge, replenish your dopamine systems in order to go again. If you were doing two of them a day, 7 days a week, it is unsustainable.
Right.
It is unsustainable because you will struggle to continue. And by the time you do the seventh day, you won't even want to be there.
Mm.
You'll be sick of it, Spence. And you'll be thinking, really can't be bothered with this today. which is why when we have our scheduling at T2, I know it's important for you to have breaks in your schedule, even if you just sat in the office getting your bearings and recharging and resting to go again.
Yeah.
And this is where the going back to addiction, imagine the crash you get from a big night on taking illegal substances. It's through the floor. The post elation depression is real. So what do they do to get rid of it?
Well, that thing over there made me feel good.
So I'll go and do it again.
Yeah.
And then you get stuck on this cycle of reliance where no longer can I remotely feel normal without having this in my life.
And when you say that, I mean, I know you mentioned about Class A drugs, about the narcotic sort of thing, but it's interesting to sort of put this into the context of other people. So a young kid on video games.
Exactly the same thing. Video games is an interesting topic at the minute, and there's plenty of research on it. But the brains being scanned by gamers are doing the exact same things in terms of the amount of dopamine release that they're having over completing a stage or a level or winning a new weapon or, you know, whatever it is game that they're playing. And therefore, if you're a parent and you wonder why your kids are even struggling to come away from it just to have their evening meal, that they can't even bear a 30-minute break. They've got themselves into this continuous addictive series of events.
Yeah.
But that's what things like online gaming are doing to the brain.
And because especially, I know we're talking about the world. It's not just young kids that do this. It's not just young kids that do video games. However, the young kids haven't got the capacity for logical and rational thought that we have. So they're living in that sort of, that amygdala, that sort of chimp area. So they're all about emotions and feelings, aren't they? So these brain chemicals, the dopamine and things like that, that's playing a game with them. The game's designers, the success of their game is totally based on how many people are playing it for how long.
Well, if you strip this back and think about, dopamine is the molecule that released at the anticipation of achieving something or reward.
Yeah.
So you look at gaming, right?
Mm.
Gaming is a 24/7, every nanosecond you play it, there is anticipation of achieving something or reward.
Yeah.
Right? So if I do this experiment, if my son, for example, he's 9, I'm quite restrictive on the amount of time he can have, given what we do for a living and what we know. If I let him have an hour and a half on his PlayStation before a rugby or a football game, all he does is sit in the chair. He's not doing anything physical. He's playing on a game.
Yeah.
He'll come off that game to get into the car to go to the football or rugby game. And he's like a zombie, Spence. Mm. He's tired. He's yawning. He's rubbing his eyes. I can't get any conversation out of him. And I know it's going to be a bad day at the office for him. If I restrict him from any gaming on the day or night of a football or rugby match, he's a different person in the car.
Mm.
He's chatting my head off. He's talking about what he's going to do in the game. He's asking me a million questions and his energy is high.
Right.
And that is because if he's been gaming for 2 hours before a football or rugby game, he has depleted his system. He's got no motivation left to go and he's probably thinking, I really don't even want to go out there and play in this weather today, because he's got no anticipation and motivation left due to it.
If I did that, that would make me happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it that's an example of it and how it works. And I know there's a lot more research and concerns going on about the amount of Generation Z, Alpha and Beta who are gaming, who are growing up in a world where gaming inside is far outweighs playing outside and physical activity.
Yeah.
So it's having an impact on our younger generation's physical fitness, but most importantly for me, it is altering the way their dopamine systems work in the brain.
Right.
It's not only depleting them, Spence, it's got the potential over time to completely alter that system. Whether you can get that back or not at that time is a really interesting question.
Right, okay.
You know, if you formed a habit of habituating over a continuous depleted system, over that amount of time during the critical years of your brain development, is there a wonder why we're seeing, and my book goes here, and I'm bold about this, Spence, now because I know enough about it, I've researched it enough, and there is enough out there. When you look at the data from my book, there's five generations living all on this planet right now. The two generations with the highest rates of mental health, depression, or a co-occurring disorder, such as bipolar, OCD, ADHD, whatever it might be, are Generation Z and the younger generations of Alpha and Beta.
Right.
Up to 70% of Generation Z reported in a vast survey, and I quote the source in my book, that they didn't feel like they had good mental health compared with baby boomers and the silent generation, the older generations, who over half of them, 60% of them, said they had good, very good, stable mental health.
So when you say that, just to sort of quantify this, the most recent generations.
Yes.
Right.
Generation Z through to Generation Alpha and Beta, which are the three youngest generations.
And bearing in mind that we were talking about predominantly about gaming then, but that's one aspect. I mean, what about social media?
This is it. I mean, you think about a person's world now, and it's not just those generations. We mid generations, as I call them, of early millennials, Gen X, baby boomers. Let's look at those. You know, that we're accessing social media, phones, we're accessing information. Some of us are gaming. Some of us are online gambling. Yeah. A lot of them are online gambling. So we all live the same environment, the same lives, but what we're really focusing on here is the younger generations are digitally native.
Yes.
We've had to learn it.
Yeah.
And we were brought up in an era where we didn't have it. So we didn't alter too much the way the brain operates throughout those formative years. If you're digitally native, i.e. you've grown up with it and it's been there since day one.
Never known a world without it.
Not only that, but you've had overexposure to it from such an early age.
Yeah.
Such an early age. And we will not know the full result of that until we look at the trends and the research in maybe 15, 20 years' time.
Okay.
But so, you can see my point around how it's... And it's not a coincidence how it's correlating with a rise in mental health of young people, a poor mental health for young people.
Right. So we've talked about mental health. We talked about this depletion of dopamine and the slow replenishing of dopamine. And we talked about the mental health thing. However, when we are not experiencing those highs, how does it present itself? What behaviours? How does it manifest itself in? So you don't necessarily look at somebody and say, well, you've got low mental health or poor mental health. You look at somebody and go...
Yeah. Well, it presents in low mood, for one. Low mood is a common term now. We talked about a lot, which is, you know, that feeling of being in a blue state. I am not... If 10 was the barometer... And 10 was, I am absolutely ecstatic on top of the world. 5 was, I'm just nice and comfortable and even and indifferent and I'm fine. You know, a low mood would be a 3. Between a 3 and a 4.
Right, okay.
I think if you're going down to the scale of 1 and 2, you're starting to get depressed. You know, you're starting to depress the system. Yeah.
Okay.
But a low mood would be, I'm just left of center on my scale. I feel quite low. I've got no energy. I've got no interest in anything.
Yeah.
Don't want to do anything. I'm indifferent to stuff, which we know that then the habits formed in low mood are, I'll go back to doing the systematic things that I do. Gaming, social media, shopping, eating, whatever it is that can remotely give me that sense of normality.
Yeah, okay. And also, we've got to sort of say that it's not just the online stuff and the gaming stuff that can mess with your brain chemicals. There's all sorts of conditions and situations we can find ourselves in. I mean, the thing that we talked about recently was menopause. Yeah. How does that affect your brain chemicals?
Wow, yeah. So there's so many different facets to this, isn't there? I mean, what I do in the book is I explain... You know, the core functions, I explain challenge, threat, and neutral state, and I explain dopamine and the impact on motivation and systems. The multi versions of that, the nuances of the different circumstances that can play with this system are massive.
Yeah.
From like we've already explored with the younger generation, from online activities, digital drugs, to the what we consume in our bodies, to trauma and life events, mm-hmm. losing loved ones, being ill, losing a job, a breakdown in a relationship, an abusive relationship, an accident. You know, there can be so many physical things in the world, anchors we call them in psychology, mm-hmm. which can alter this system mm-hmm. and which can, you know, can affect the state of mind.
Yeah.
Menopause, you know, hormonal changes in the body mm-hmm. can absolutely play with these systems. Of course they can. Yeah. And that's why menopause over recent years has become such a big thing in the workplace, because we never ever thought of it as something that women need to be supported with.
Mm.
And that shouldn't really affect your work.
Mm.
Well, I'm sorry, it does. Just as if you're depressed, it affects your work. Or if you're ill and you've got an autoimmune disease, it affects your work. Or if you're physically disabled, it affects your work. So I think we're becoming more educated around things like menopause, how that affects the system, how the hormone imbalance
mm.
can completely change the dynamic of your biochemistry,
yeah.
which then can do lots of different things. From it can increase that cortisol, adrenaline, feeling anxious, feeling worried, feeling overly in survival mode and defensive, and it can significantly reduce your ability to, you know, enjoy pleasure, reward, and mm-hmm. feel optimistic about yeah. the world and the future, for sure. So, yeah, there's lots of different things that we've got to take into account. But coming back to it, everything, all roads lead back to the fact that we're an animal,
yeah,
driven by survival, reproduction, and purpose, that can be in one of these three psychological states, challenge, threat, or neutral. And we have these neuromodulators, brain chemicals for simple ease, like cortisol, adrenaline, dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, that play a huge role in how we think, feel, act, and behave.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Just want to step away from the brain chemical bit. But not totally away, because obviously everything is linked, isn't it? It's like we designed it this way. But in a recent Hubcast, I talked about hedonic and eudaimonic well-being, hedonic and eudaimonic happiness. So hedonic is about the here and now, that immediate reward, that immediate happiness. Eudaimonic is more about the long-term stuff, the sort of, have I got purpose? What am I working towards? However, you mentioned, and I don't really want to go into this myself, I want to hear what you say, but you talk about, high road motivation and low road motivation. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're using words there that are in my wheelhouse, hedonism, hedonic. We can get to some, you know, my feeling as always with these books, Spence, is if I was in my geeky playground of psychology, neuroscience, and, you know, performance psychology, I could use all these words and, you know, and be in my element. But one of my roles is to simplify for the reader things that are relatable and digestible and understandable. So I created two terminologies for the book to best describe exactly what you've just described, instead of using the words like hedonic. So I created low road versus high road motivation. And what I mean by that is, given everything we've just talked about on this pod so far, low road motivation is categorized by the things we choose to do, which will carry very little effort or energy, and they will deliver instant, if not very quick and timely, gains, gratifications, and rewards.
Right.
So if you take the low road, you're deciding on doing something that's going to be instant and give you instant fulfillment, gratification, reward.
For minimal output.
For minimum effort and output.
Yeah. Right.
Whereas the high road motivation is where you're pushing into that challenge state a bit more and going, do you know what? This is going to be difficult. I'm going to have to do this over a period of time, or it's going to take a longer period of time. It's going to take more effort and energy. And guess what? The rewards aren't going to be instant. In fact, they're going to be delayed. The gratification or the results I desire might be significantly delayed, and they may not happen at all. So the high road is like unattractive for the brain.
And the low road is incredibly attractive for the brain. So let me give you should we do a couple of examples?
Yeah,
just
sure. Yeah.
So an example of this is you want to get in shape.
Mm-hmm.
It's a classic one for all of us, right? We know we're not doing enough. We need to get some fitness and get in shape.
Yeah, yeah.
So your brain does a quick calculation on what I'm going to do here, and it comes up with two options. The high road option is, right, join the gym, £100 a month. Mm. Already this is seeing quite, you know, for many already people are checked out, right?
Yeah.
£100 a month, you're going to have to do 4 sessions a week, so maybe 5 hours dedicated of your time a week.
Mm.
It's going to hurt like crazy. You're going to be aching like mad. It's not going to be pleasant to actually do in the first place. And guess what? You probably won't even see any difference in the first few weeks, months.
Mm.
So you're going to have to commit to this, let's say, for 6 months. You're going to have to make a habit out of it. In order to maximize it, you're going to have to eat well, clean your eating and drinking up. You're going to have to sleep well, and it's going to have to become a major priority and commitment for you in your life. High road.
Mm.
But at the end of that 6 months, the rewards are going to be so great and almost guaranteed if you follow it. Then your brain does another quick calculation and goes, low road. What's the low road alternative?
Mm.
Well, you could save yourself the gym membership fee. You could go on Amazon, buy yourself an abs machine and some weight loss pills. Give that a go first.
Yeah.
Okay. And I know that's a silly thing, but before I know it, I'm at home, I've ordered an abs machine and some weight loss pills and some Herbal Life.
Yeah.
And I'm ready to go. I'm going to lose some weight.
Yeah.
Because, and then you take the pills and you put the abs machine on for half an hour each evening and you quickly realize that none of your other habits have changed and this isn't going to work. The low road wins again.
Mm.
And there's so many examples I give in the book, taking the lift versus taking the stairs, you know, going out with friends versus staying in and binging on Netflix, going out to the supermarket on the way home, getting some fresh produce and ingredients, which is going to be an hour out your way.
Mm.
You're going to go home, you're going to cook a freshly cooked meal. It's going to take another hour. You're going to enjoy the meal. Then you've got the cleanup operation, but you know it's good for you. Nah, let's not do that. Let's go on Just Eat, order a takeaway. It'll be at my doorstep in 10 minutes. It's going to taste nicer.
Yeah.
Low road wins again.
Yeah.
So it's a simple way of getting people, when they read the book, to go, am I forming a habit of taking low road motivation options over high road motivation options time and time again, and is that serving me well? And the answer to that will be no.
Mm.
But we live in a world today where there is a low road alternative to every single thing that we once had to go and work hard for.
Okay.
And that's an interesting concept for me in terms of how that's playing out and contributing to this this problem we've got with pain and pleasure.
Right. Cool. Okay. That's interesting, that. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Last thing from me.
Okay. Because this could last 3 hours, this podcast.
Right. Okay. So with regards to I Am Human, Pain and Pleasure.
Yeah.
Specifically chapter 2.
Yeah.
What have we not talked about that we should have talked about?
With the pain and pleasure complex?
Yeah.
I guess what I've tried to do in the book is stage the chapters effectively so that what I was very keen on doing with a topic like this, Spence, was if you cram it all in just a chronological big mess of neuroscience, the reader will quickly get switched off. And if you think about I Am Human, 30 Mistakes to Success, what was most successful about that book is we chopped it up into 30 short, simple, digestible areas.
Mm.
So my brain can focus on 4 pages and 1 concept at a time.
Mm.
And I wanted, although this was a slightly different feel to the book, I wanted to achieve the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had to be very clear on what chapter 2, the pain and pleasure complex, what needed to go into that? Where do I start and where do I stop?
Mm.
Otherwise, there's a whole book on that.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
We've probably done over an hour here, maybe longer. We've done over an hour here just on dopamine, right? So I was very clear on, don't put too much in, make the point, move on to the next one, then we'll use the next chapter of it. So I guess what could have gone into chapter 2, but it doesn't, it comes into actually chapter 4 and 5, I believe.
All right.
Which is, okay, so given what we've just said about the pain and pleasure complex, what are the characteristics and attributes that we require to push ourselves into pain more often, high road, and challenged it and endure it? And what are the characteristics we need to go on our endeavors to be able to achieve our goals and our visions and achieve pleasure and reward? And I go into that in length in chapter 5 and 6 because I just didn't want to shoehorn it into here.
Yeah.
Given we'd already gone over an awful amount of information.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't know about you, but I think chapters 1 and 2 almost cover the entire evolution of human history and the pain and pleasure complex in the brain.
Yeah.
I think people are going to be putting the book down after chapter 2 and sort of going, whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hang on a second. Let me just consume some of this. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So I thought it was important.
Very much so.
That answers the question.
I think that was one of the big ticks in the box for 30 Mistakes to Success was the fact that it was so accessible that you could read. You could theoretically read those 4 pages and then put it to one side and go, right, what does that look like in my world? Well, you could do it over 30 days.
Well, it might be a good place to finish just to give people listening a flavour of the journey they're going to go on.
Yeah.
The way I've staged it is 10 chapters. Chapter 1 is unquestionably human. Mm. It's the history of Homo sapiens and how we're governed by these 3 core things of survival, reproduction, and purpose. Chapter 2 goes into the pain and pleasure complex. We've talked a lot about it today. Yeah. What is pain and what is pleasure? What we haven't talked about today is I talk about the skin and the brain and how we actually receive pain and pleasure into the body. So that's the pain and pleasure complex. And then we go into the midsections of the book because the midsections of the book is going, right, although we know we're a species that has this and we get it, how are we all weirdly, wonderful, unique? Mm. So I go into attributes for pain, characteristics and attributes to endure pain, characteristics and attributes to receive pleasure. I go into your nature and nurture.
All right, okay.
So the unique combination of the genes passed down to you by your parents and your environmental influences, parents, education, social, and your upbringing. We go into your worldview. So what is your view of the world? This is by far the most provocative chapter in the book.
Mm.
You know, big questions. How do you believe the world was made, religion or science? Mm. Is there life after death? Do you believe in a more right or left stance on politics? And how does that influence your pain and pleasure experience in the world?
Like, yeah.
Really fascinating stuff about the way you view the world.
Mm.
And then after that, we talk about generations. There's an entire chapter on generational shift. I go from the silent generation through to baby boomers, through to Gen X, through to millennials and Generation Z of today. Mm. And we even look at alpha and beta for the future.
Right.
And we look at all the environments they grow up in and how our relationship with pain and pleasure has changed through the last 100 years.
Right, okay.
And then we end up with, okay, so what can we do about this? Mm. How do we balance the scales? And chapter 9 is full of hints and tips of finding that balance with our pain and pleasure.
Mm.
And finally, the future. What does the next 50 years look like?
Mm.
What going to present the biggest challenges to our ability to get our dopamine systems back on track, to get our high and low road motivation balance back, and to be able to endure pain and suffering in equal measure as receiving pleasure and reward? So that's the book.
Yeah.
Lot more in it, and I'm proud of it. It's been good a slog, stuff. But I'm quietly optimistic.
Awesome. When's it hitting the shelves?
7th of May, we launch at the T2 Retreat. I'll be doing a keynote on it, and then the week after that, so what will that be, the 13th of May, something like that, it will be live on Amazon for purchasing. So watch out for the end of May.
Yeah.
And we'll be putting loads out on our socials around it. And hopefully people read it.
Excellent. I Am Human, Pain and Pleasure, coming to a store near you very shortly. Martin Johnson, thank you very much.
Spencer Locker, I loved it. As always with you, thank you.
Excellent. And we'll be back with another T2 Hubcast very shortly. Bye-bye now.